I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we will meet the Ripped Reverend. She is an Episcopal priest and competitive bodybuilder. That conversation is just ahead in Faith Matters. But before we talk about fitness, we wanted to talk about sickness. And if you've been listening to the network this week, then we hope you have caught some of the segments from NPR's series, Sick in America. NPR partnered with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Harvard School of Public Health to interview more than 1,500 adults to try to find out what it's like to be sick in America and to figure out whether attitudes about health care of people who have recently been sick differ from those of the people who have not. And the results are striking. People who actually needed health care in the last year had much more negative views than people who did not. And there were some interesting clues about why. Nearly half of the people who had been sick said that a lack of cultural understanding was a major reason for problems with the quality of U.S. health care. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called upon NPR health and science correspondent Richard Knox. He culled through that data and talked to a lot of people about their experiences. We're also joined by Dr. Kavita Patel. She is a practicing primary care physician. She's also a fellow at the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at the Brookings Institution. I want to thank you both so much for being here.
Sure.
Thank you for having me.
And I just want to say there are so many things that we could talk about. We can only touch on a few. And we just want to focus on a couple of the things that stood out to us. And earlier this week, we talked to Brittany Cooper, and I'd like to get both of your takes on her story. Brittany is an assistant professor at Rutgers University. She's the co-founder of a blog called the Crunk Feminist Collective. She was admitted to a hospital in South New Jersey earlier last month for a stomach issue. A doctor gave her a pregnancy test. She says 12 hours later, a different doctor ordered another pregnancy test, and we'll let her tell the story from here.
So I reaffirmed for him quite insistently that, in fact, I was not pregnant, that there was no possibility of it. And then he said to me, well, because, I mean, if we give you these drugs, it could really harm the baby. And I said, there is not a baby. And finally, he let it go, but with this very strict look towards me as if to say, and what he actually did say to me, you know, because there are liability issues involved. So there was this complete disbelief, even though his own hospital had done the test 12 hours prior.
So, Richard, let me start with you. This whole question of communication, was that a big issue in the people that you spoke with?
Yes, it certainly was. I mean, it's understandable they'd ask about pregnancy and they really want to be sure for the reasons that she said. But not being aware of the earlier pregnancy test yet, that sounds familiar. About 30% of the hospitalized people, recently hospitalized people who answered our poll, they reported poor communication among the caregivers. And then when we put out a call on Facebook to ask people to share their experiences, and we got hundreds, you know, hundreds and hundreds of responses, and we went through every one of them. There were a lot of complaints about poor communication and disrespectful treatment. One woman said that the hospital felt like a factory. Another said, you know, nobody was talking to anybody else. There was a complete lack of coordination. In the poll, about 1 in 7 said they had to redo a test because the earlier results were lost. And about 1 in 5 said that they were not treated with dignity or respect.
Dr. Patel, at the Brookings Institution, one of the things you're actually working on are trying to come up with solutions to this issue. And what have you come up with?
We actually would echo exactly what your patients have been telling you, Richard, on Facebook and from the perspective of health professionals, that they feel like they're helpless in this because the payment system and healthcare, as well as the way we still live in this siloed nature and paper charts, still do exist. And that's why these tests get repeated. So we're trying to work on payment solutions as well as systems approaches that can improve the healthcare experience for everybody and so that we don't have problems like what Brittany's story brought up.
Now, there's also a social aspect to this. I mean, we talked about two things. We talked about the communication among the healthcare professionals. We also talked about the communication with the patient, and this is another thing that Brittany told us when she was talking to a nurse. Brittany says the nurse was surprised that she was a professor because of the way she wears her hair. I just want to let her tell the story from here.
I needed to remind myself that whereas I saw myself as a sick patient, what these doctors were seeing was a woman who has a weight problem, a dark-skinned black woman with this kind of natural hair that was unkempt. So all of those things culturally, I think, are coded to mean that I'm working class, perhaps a welfare case. And then there's all of this disdain that comes with being a welfare case in our current medical system.
Dr. Patel, that is actually, Brittany is expressing herself in a very calm and elegant way. But what she's saying is actually, I think, very damning. And I'd like to ask whether your experience as a practicing physician, is that true? And are people in the medical profession aware of the fact that this is how that they are viewed? They are viewed as making quick assessments, essentially profiling people.
We have a great deal of research that goes back decades looking at so many of the factors that contribute to what I think you alluded to earlier, which is just disparities in care as well, that people are not receiving quality care across the same consistent levels in this country. And just from a personal experience as a practicing physician, I've been trained to think about everybody. Everything I do from the moment a patient walks in the door, my background in medical training puts into place a series of observations about a way a patient speaks, a way that they particularly are walking into my office and sitting in front of me. And so I think what Brittany's story is showing us are some of the vulnerabilities in our system. However, I would definitely tell you that we have a lot of awareness about where we need to make progress, and that's much more important. And I think what your poll has shown is that both patients and the healthcare system itself is very sick and needs to find a way to be better.
Are you saying that there are some ways in which profiling is actually necessary? Like if you see someone come in who's a smoker, it's important to take that into account. Is that what you're saying? But you're saying, help me understand what you're saying.
Yeah, I didn't want to use the term profiling because honestly, in my mind, I think about everything, and it's just how a person's systems are revealed to me through the way I can listen to them with a stethoscope, and that's much more clear for what doctors do. But even more importantly, we always talk in medicine that 80% of the diagnosis is the story of a patient. And that story literally begins once they walk into the door and I can see them. And so I think where Brittany's story is really unfortunate is that somebody made a series of judgments, it sounds like. However, I can tell you that that is not the way any of my own practice or my own colleagues have ever, ever been trained. And so what I think is more important to learn from Brittany's story is that we have a lot of patients who are frustrated with the experience, the communication, and the way the system is treating them. And I think that that's something that we have to work on more collectively as a society.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about NPR's survey about what it's like to be sick in America. We're just scratching the surface here with NPR health and science correspondent Richard Knox and Dr. Kavita Patel of the Brookings Institution. She's also a practicing physician. Richard, I want to just talk a little bit more about that. And again, I want to emphasize that the series over the course of the week has covered many, many issues. And if people are interested in digging in further, we'd love for people to go to npr.org and dig in further and listen to a number of the reports that have aired this week. The report did not hone in on racial and ethnic issues per se, but were there areas in which you saw some important racial divides that were, or ethnic divides that were important to point out?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think it's important to point out that the poll was designed, and this is unusual as polls go, to compare the experiences of people who have been recently sick versus people who hadn't. And we saw some interesting divides. As you mentioned at the outset, nearly half, 47% of people who had recent contact with the U.S. healthcare system said that they thought lack of cultural understanding is a problem in U.S. healthcare. If you look at people who hadn't had recent contact, it was 30%, which is a pretty substantial share. But, you know, people who had recent contact really felt more strongly about that. When we asked people about their care, only about 6% said they were treated poorly because of their race or ethnicity or cultural background or the language they spoke, which is a little bit surprising and inconsistent. I think probably the difference is that the 6% response is kind of diluted because most of those people were not minorities. If we had enough numbers to look at minorities as a subgroups and parse it that way, we probably would have gotten more of those kinds of responses, I'm guessing.
Dr. Patel, we have a couple of minutes left, and I just wanted to ask, in the time that we have left, are there things that patients can do to make the experience better? Because I think that what stands out for me in reading the survey is just a level of frustration, a level of fear. I mean, there were stories of, you know, the financial burden, say, of illness, of for some people, you know, the experience of people who, even with health insurance, finding that the burden of being sick is far greater than they thought it would be. Are there just some things that you think people can do right now that are within their own power to make this experience better?
Absolutely. The first thing is to, especially in the case of Brittany, I as a primary care doctor, wanted to be able to tell Brittany, I wish you had a primary care physician who actually knew that you needed to go into the emergency room and could also help talk you through what that process would be like. So the first thing would be get a primary care physician. If that's hard to do, try to find out from some of the websites like healthreform.gov and others how to get a physician in your area, which these websites can help you with. The second thing is to do a little bit of intelligence and research. I know sometimes emergencies don't let you do that, but the web has offered us a lot of highly reliable resources from the National Institutes of Health and other agencies within and outside of the government, as well as, I think NPR.org has had a number of these forums in which we can get a better sense of what an experience would be like. And I think that talking to your other friends who have had similar experiences is the final piece of advice, because we all have a sense of where we can go, which doctors and which health professionals have that sense of what I think we're all looking for, which is humanity and professionalism. And that's certainly what I was trained with, and that's certainly how I've tried to practice every day. And so those are three basic tips. But first, starting with someone who knows you. That's what all my patients have, and that's what I think is the essential element of truly coordinated care.
Dr. Kavita Patel is a primary care physician. She's a fellow at the Engelberg Center for Healthcare Reform at the Brookings Institute. She was kind enough to join us from our bureau in New York. Richard Knox is a health and science correspondent here at NPR. He joined us from his home office in the Boston area. Thank you both so much for speaking with us. So much more to talk about.
Thank you.
Happy to help.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, we'll get a fresh cut on some of the week's stories from the guys in the barbershop. That's in just a few minutes. But first, we turn to Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith and spirituality. And with Memorial Day upon us, for a lot of people, that means the beginning of beach season. So we decided to ask, what does faith have to do with being buff? We thought our next guest would be just the person to tell us, because as an Episcopal priest, the Reverend Amy Richter would be the first to tell you she's most interested in what is going on inside a person rather than on the outside. But somewhere along the way, she decided to break out her inner Miss Universe. She began competing in physique competitions in 2004, starting with the Wisconsin State Fair, and she did pretty well. More recently, she decided to out herself and write about her experience in the New York Times, and she's here to tell us more. Welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us, Reverend Richter.
Thanks for having me.
And I do have to say, you do look great.
Thank you very much.
Why did you start working out?
Well, I had been a runner for many years and really enjoyed that, but it was really a personal experience that led me to want to work out with weights more. My mother had a very short, fierce battle with cancer about 13 years ago now, and I think she was part of a generation that was never quite at home in her body. She was a very healthy person and a lovely person and a strong person, but she was almost always on a diet, and she expressed a lot of dissatisfaction. It, nothing extreme, but something that I've heard a lot of other women from her generation express. And I remember when my mother died, as we were waiting for the people from the funeral home to come, my father said, "I need to go say goodbye to your mother's body." And I must have looked at him questioningly or something. He said, "You know, I know that's not all of who your mother was, but that's the body I woke up to every day for 35 years. That's the body that gave birth to you and your brothers. That's the body your mother had when I fell in love with her." And I was so struck by that and thought, I really need to make sure that I make friends with my physical self and really explore what my body can do. So I had been doing some weightlifting. And I thought, you know, here's something I'm going to push myself on a little and explore a little more.
And I'm sorry about your mom, by the way.
Oh,
I'm sorry about that. But I'm sorry for your loss. But I can see that there are a number of women who, not just women, but people who once they kind of get into it and realize that they can be stronger, it gets good and it starts to feel good. And people think, yeah, this is great. But that's a, kind of a journey to then deciding you're going to compete in a physique competition.
Yes.
And the reason I think it's particularly interesting is it's not, it has been a struggle for many people to see women in the pulpit. And for most of the world's religions, modesty is a part of that for both men and women.
Yes.
So then I have to ask, the journey to deciding, you know what, I'm not only not going to lift, but I'm going to strut my stuff. I want to know.
Yes.
How did that mental journey take place?
Well, I love having new experiences, and I do think that that's one of the great gifts God gives us, a chance to meet people you'd never meet if you didn't put yourself out there in some ways. And something that's also true about being a minister in any form, but I think women have really sort of brought that to the fore, is that a lot of ministry and serving in the church is about cooperation and teamwork and empowering others. And I'm kind of a competitive person, so I thought, here's one way that I can put my competitive energy into something positive, where it's not appropriate in my job to, you know, be trying to one-up somebody or, you know, I know more about this than you do or something like that. And the strangest thing about it for me was this idea that rather than being, you know, almost completely covered up like I am on regular Sunday mornings, that I would be standing in a competition suit, which is designed to be modest enough, but still show a maximum amount of skin so that the judges can tell whether you're muscular enough.
And you did pretty well.
I did.
First time out.
Yeah, not too bad.
You came in number two.
I wish I'd come in number one.
I see. How come you didn't tell anybody, though? You didn't tell your congregation at the time. Why do you think you didn't?
I wasn't sure how they would take it. And I think it can be such a leap for some people from a woman in the pulpit, modest, to out there and showing off in a way. And I kind of wanted to see how I'd do, too. And
to be really honest.
Yeah.
So how did it go when it finally, you know, was when all was revealed?
You know, it was really fun. I did get to, it was a glimpse into a different world than I generally hang out with on Sunday mornings. It's a different kind of competition, too. I had done a number of marathons and running events where the event takes so long and is effort the whole way through. And in this kind of competition, it's a little different in that all of the training comes and preparation is before. The event itself, I know there's some technique involved and effort involved on that day, but it's more like just showing off the fruits of your labor instead of having to run for 4 hours or however long it takes to complete a long run. But it was, I enjoyed it even more than I thought I would.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. My guest is the Reverend Dr. Amy Richter, and we are talking about her foray into bodybuilding, if you can believe that. What are people saying now? I don't know if people at the time knew, because this was your first competition was back in 2004, and you had your trophy.
I had my big trophy.
How have people reacted to it now that it has emerged that this is something you're interested in?
I told a few people at the time, and reaction was mixed. A number of people from church said, that's great. There were a few people who said, you know, I'm not sure we're ready to know that about you. Now I'm happy to report that people who've responded to me directly, both people I know and emails I've received, have been very complimentary. And a number of people said, that's really great and inspiring and wonderful. And people have asked some really good questions, too, about what does it mean to fully embrace our embodied self, and particularly for women to do that. There have also been some, I think, negative comments that were posted to the New York Times site and some blogs.
What's the gist of it? That it's immodest?
Some of that.
Vain? Or just, I don't want to see all that. That's like seeing my mom in a bathing suit. I don't want to see that.
Not so much that. More sort of comments that I've heard all along about, you know, it's not right for women to be ordained, or it's not right for women to be up in front of people in an immodest way.
And what do you say to that?
Well, first of all, it's hard to imagine a more wholesome environment than the Wisconsin State Fair. So you got to keep that in mind, too. The context was family entertainment and really a wholesome environment. I also think maybe it's really time to embrace who we are. And that also means celebrating that we have bodies. And let's do what we can to be as healthy as possible. And I don't think that means that we have to cover up all things in the right context, I guess, is also what I would say.
What have you sort of arrived at in terms of thinking again about the connection between your physical health and your spiritual health and how all that works together? Because, you know, there are cultures who feel that this country's willingness to have women uncover is a sign of our lack of respect for women, as opposed to the agency of women, as opposed to the power of women.
Right.
So I'm just wondering how you, when you think of all those together.
And that's a really good question. And I think it's the difference between choosing to compete in an athletic competition. You know, that's a very different context than having no choice about what you do with your body. But I also think, at least within the Christian tradition, being an embodied self is really at the core of the Christian faith. And what I've come to is, I think, a deeper appreciation for myself and my faith about what it means. And it's still a mystery to me. I'll never completely wrap my brain around it. But at the core of our faith is this belief that the divine took on human flesh, and that in this person of Jesus, the divine experienced human reality, not just in a spiritual way, but in a physical embodied way. So, you know, this divine being experienced hunger and delight in his human self, in God's human reality in Jesus. So, you know, it's interesting. We just celebrated the Feast of the Ascension, which is kind of a curious, I think, Christian tradition, in which we say, so this man was born, lived a human life fully, died a real human death, was raised with some kind of a resurrection body, and then in his body was taken up into heaven. And the point, or part of the point of that in the Christian tradition, is that so some kind of physical resurrected body was accepted into heaven. The point for us as people then is that this physical self that I hopefully enjoy someday in some form will also be acceptable in heaven. That's really amazing. So our embodied reality is not something to be rejected or avoided or thought of as a lesser part of our existence, but actually something to be enjoyed and used and put into the service of God and others.
Okay, so how much can you lift? Come on. Come on.
I can
give it up.
Right now I'm at bench pressing 130 pounds.
Not bad.
Yeah.
The Reverend Dr. Amy Richter is senior pastor at St. Anne's Parish in Annapolis, Maryland. She recently published the essay, The Ripped Bikini-Clad Reverend, in the New York Times Magazine about her first bodybuilding competition. And she was kind enough to join us in our NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Reverend Richter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now it's time for Back Talk. That's where we lift the curtain on what's happening in the Tell Me More blogosphere and hear from you. Editor Ahmad Omar is here with us once again. What do you have for us today, Ahmad?
We've got a lot of news updates today, and we want to start in the Middle East. There's news there that Zainab Al-Khawaja has been arrested and jailed for a month in Bahrain. We spoke to Zainab on this program in April. She and her family have been demonstrating against the monarchy that rules that nation. But according to the Associated Press, Zainab was accused of abusing a policewoman at a protest. She'll reportedly have another court appearance this weekend. Zainab's father, Abdul Hadi Al-Khawaja, is a Bahraini dissident who's been sentenced to life for his part in what supporters say are peaceful protests. He's been on hunger strike, and she's been calling for his release. Here's a clip from our conversation with Zainab last month.
I mean, we have been punished for a very long time now. My father is one example, and the price that he had to pay for that is the way that he was arrested. They broke his jaw in four different places. My father now has more than 20 metal plates and screws holding his jaw together. He was tortured for more than 2 months. He was kept in solitary confinement.
Well, Zainab's father is continuing his hunger strike, and he was in court in a wheelchair this week. He's reportedly having his life sentence reexamined.
And we are going to continue to follow this important story. Ahmad, what else?
Well, on a lighter note, we mentioned earlier this week that Hikaru Nakamura won the U.S. Chess Championship over the weekend. We spoke with him earlier this month as part of our Game Changer series for Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. On Saturday, Hikaru capped an undefeated run to the championship. Since then, he's been to New York for a charity chess event there, and he's flying off to Russia now to take on some of the best players there. Oh, and he's got a $40,000 winner's check to help him enjoy those sights and sounds.
What? Oh, well. Congratulations, Hikaru. And Ahmad, I think you also have some news from the Twitterverse.
Earlier this week, we spoke to Julian Bond. He's the chairman emeritus of the NAACP because the historic civil rights group came out in support of gay marriage. Bond said he hoped the NAACP resolution would encourage people of color who oppose gay marriage to reconsider. Well, we got a tweet from the user Mimi1PokerDiva that said, "Just because the NAACP endorses gay marriage, it doesn't mean African Americans and Latin Americans will follow their lead. The NAACP no longer represents the majority of African Americans and Latin Americans."
Well, actually, we have some news about that, too. There's a new ABC News Washington Post poll just out today that says that the number of African Americans who do want to legalize same-sex marriage is on the rise. 59% of black respondents to that poll said that they do want to legalize same-sex marriage, and 65% said that they favor President Obama's position on the issue. So there it is. It's an evolving story. Anything else?
Well, we wanted to end by taking a moment to remember Hal Jackson. He was a broadcaster who broke down color barriers in radio. He died Wednesday at the age of 96. Here he is talking to NPR a little over 10 years ago about how he walked into a D.C. radio executive's office and asked for his own show back in 1939.
He said to me, "Use the N-word. No N will ever work on this radio station, and I doubt any others. They're none working in Washington, you know." I said, "I know how much it would mean to the black people of Washington if we had a show."
Well, Hal Jackson rounded up his own sponsors and bought airtime through an ad agency for an overnight slot, and he just walked into the station again 15 minutes before airtime.
Everybody was stunned. And I was scheduled to go on. They couldn't locate the manager wherever he was. Anyway, we went on the air, and the phones just lit up.
Hal Jackson's career took off from there. He wound up hosting three different daily shows on three different New York stations in the mid-1950s. He worked hard in the civil rights movement. He pushed for integrated swimming pools and organized integrated concerts. And he worked throughout his life to help young people. In 1990, he became the first black person elected to the National Association of Broadcasters Hall of Fame. And he kept doing his weekly radio show on WBLS in New York until just a few weeks ago.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Sunday Classics. I'm Hal Jackson.
It is truly the end of an era, and our condolences go out to his family. Thanks, Ahmad.
Thank you, Michelle.
And remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. To tell us more, you can call our comment line at 202-842-3522 or visit us online at npr.org/tellmemore. Please remember to leave us your name. You can also find us on Twitter. Just look for @TellMeMoreNPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now it's time for our weekly visit to the barbershop, where the guys talk about what's in the news and what's on their minds. Sitting in the chairs for a shape-up this week, our freelance journalist Jimmy Israel. He happens to be in Washington this week. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, Michelle.
Also in Washington, D.C., civil rights attorney and author Arsalan Iftikhar, NPR digital news correspondent Corey Dade. And with us from Austin, Texas, Mario Loyola. He is a columnist for the National Review magazine and director of the Center for 10th Amendment Studies at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. That's a conservative think tank that focuses on the impact of federal policy on states. Take it away, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. Hey, fellas, welcome to the shop. How we doing?
Hey.
¿Qué pasa?
Jimmy.
Super Mario, what's up, man? C. Dade, good to see you.
Thank you, sir.
All right, well, I hate to get things started off on a somber note. Sadly, we do. Let's start talking about new revelations in the death of Robert Champion. You remember, he's the Florida A&M University drum major who died in November, allegedly after an intense beating by fellow bandmates during a hazing ritual. 13 band members have been charged in Champion's death. According to new released police documents, some suspects and witnesses suggest that Champion agreed to undergo the hazing that took his life. Michelle, really?
You know, it's interesting because we've got a lot of detail, so we have more information, but I don't know that we have more clarity, because one band member has told investigators that Champion didn't want to go through the hazing but was willing to do it. He volunteered to do it, albeit reluctantly, because he thought that to become the head drum major, he needed to do this. Robert's mother, Paula Champion, said in a news conference she does not believe that. Here's a statement from the family's lawyer, Christopher Chestnut.
Whether he voluntarily got on or not, what we do know is that anyone in that band who wanted any leadership position or wanted any future in the band had their back up against the wall if they went against hazing.
Wow. I'm sorry, the Robert's mother is Pamela Champion. I'm not sure why I said Paula, but it's Pamela Champion. So, Jimmy, what do you think?
Thanks, Michelle. Well, I mean, as many of you know in the barbershop, you know, I'm a Mason. And we've had our hazing rituals, but we haven't had any. Of course, we have our hazing rituals. Nothing I can talk about, but we haven't had any deaths since 77-year-old Albert I mistakenly shot 47-year-old William James back in 2005, and there was also specialist Donald Wilder, his death overseas in 2006. And personally, I've experienced some hazing, but I mean. Nothing to this extent. It's a shame, and of course our condolences go out to the Champion family. C. Day, Corey, you went to HBCU. Is this the HBCU thing?
Absolutely.
Is it?
Yeah. Hazing takes place in marching bands. Marching bands are huge. They are big business for the universities. But to me, what's interesting is as pervasive as hazing is in marching bands, many of the band directors have been criticized for not being aggressive in stopping it. But what's interesting is in the FAMU case, you have a band director who actually suspended students for hazing, and the university reinstated those students, so the band director felt undermined. Mm-hmm. So that to me is an issue that really stands out in this case.
Why do you think that is? Well, I mean, what is it? It's just because there's such a draw that they don't want to do anything that apparently that would change the culture, even when it's lethal. I just don't understand that. Why would you?
Marching bands are big business for HBCUs. They, you know, there's a saying in at HBCUs that the fans pay to see the band, and once the halftime show is done, they leave the game. And so when you think about FAMU's band, Grambling State's band, where I went to school, these bands are nationally and sometimes world-renowned. They travel the country. They play in Super Bowls. They play in Macy's Thanksgiving Day parades. Some of them, you know, the Grambling State band was in a Coca-Cola commercial in the 70s. So this is big money for the university. They offer four-year scholarships to band players, to band members. So, you know, they have been historically reluctant to address this kind of problem because they're messing with their cash cow.
Arsalan Iftikhar.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, in addition to what Corey said, I think it's not only isolated to HBCUs. I think that fraternities and sororities around the country have hazing issues, particularly fraternities, you know, dealing with alcohol poisoning deaths that have come from hazing rituals. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I've heard of some pretty outlandish hazing incidents. But what's interesting to me as a lawyer is the fact that the 11 defendants that you mentioned were charged with third-degree felony hazing as opposed to second-degree murder or manslaughter charges. And it's interesting because under Florida statute, second-degree murder is perpetrated when there's a, quote, depraved mind, and Florida manslaughter requires, quote, culpable negligence. And what the defendants are essentially saying is because Mr. Champion consented to go on the bus, albeit nobody will ever consent to dying, you know, because of that consent, that should be considered a mitigating factor. And I think that's probably one of the reasonings that the prosecutor used in charging the third-degree felony hazing.
Well, I think, isn't the culture part of it, too? I mean, because depraved mind seems to would imply outside of the continuum of accepted behavior. And if you grow up in an environment or if you are present in an environment where that is considered acceptable, even if it is disreputable, then how can you have a depraved mind if that's what is done here?
That's a good point.
You know, I mean, I don't know. Mario, what do you think?
Well, I kind of don't know how you get from hazing to killing someone. I mean, it's what the point Arsalan brings up. I mean, I can consent to hazing, but there's no way that I can consent to my own murder. And so I just don't know how these beatings could have gotten so severe that the people who did them didn't realize that they were creating a grave likelihood of serious bodily injury or death.
That is a question I have. I mean, but it just some of it is, you know, this throwing a blanket over people, for example.
Right.
So they're deprived of air. It could be the number of people hitting. Obviously, the force of the blows. I mean, 13 people hitting one guy seems to me. And also, it would be where a person was hit. I mean, if you can, you know, there have been a number of incidents involving student athletes in the Washington, D.C. area. We're clearly unintentional. There was alcohol involved. Maybe one blow and a person falls and hits their head.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's obviously the manner of the behavior that's relevant.
Well, I have a question. What's acceptable hazing? You know what I mean? Where's the line? You know, I mean, when I became a Mason, I knew what I was up. I knew that to expect something. I didn't know exactly what to expect. I didn't know that I'd die and be raised again. I didn't know that, but I knew something would happen.
Well, can I just ask you this, Jimmy? Why does it? What from your firsthand perspective? Why does it persist? I mean, I do think that there's some relevant stuff around, you know, impulse control of kids in that age and the fact that, you know, judgment is not fully formed until the, you know, mid 20s, and there's a lot of data around that. But you're a grown man and you're a very intelligent man.
Mm-hmm.
Why do people continue to participate in something?
Let me say, by the time I was ready to make my Masonic ascent, I was a grown man and the men around me were grown men.
Yeah.
So that's a little different. But I think there's this idea that an organization or some organizations, you shouldn't be able to just walk in the door and say, I want to be a member and then become a member. There's something you should have to go through in some people's minds.
You have to pay a price.
You got to pay a price.
Right.
You know, so it shouldn't just be that you're to get your Masonic degrees, that you're proficient in this and you're that and the other. You know, you should have to, we should have to test your mettle in some way.
Why beating, though?
I didn't say I got beat.
Okay.
Corey,
tell me, why beating? We played football.
I played football, and I was hazed. Freshmen get hazed. I remember a situation that was unique. They all wanted us to have bald heads. And, you know, they were going to shave you if you didn't shave yourself. They made an example out of one of our fellow freshmen, the biggest freshman who had come in, one of the sort of incoming stars. They sent a message and they forcefully shaved his head in the middle of the dormitory floor. So we got the message. We went in our dorms and quickly shaved each other's hair real quick.
You shaved your head, bro?
Absolutely.
But you look like a milk dove with your head shaved.
I mean, that's a shade to that Mitt Romney
Or like a chocolate M&M.
Right. Well, and I also, I think what's being lost in this also is, you know, the universities involved around the country. So, you know, if you have some random fraternity of Zeta, Beta, Potato that, you know, has, you know, where somebody dies during a hazing ritual and they get a slap on the wrist, you know, maybe one semester, you know, off campus probation, things like that. I think that has led to a culture of impunity, which has grown through the years. And I think universities need to be held to account also.
Hmm.
Well, if you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. You're listening to our weekly Barbershop Roundtable. We're joined by freelance journalist Jimmy Israel, civil rights attorney Arsalan Iftikhar, NPR digital news correspondent Corey Day. They're all in Washington, D.C. In Austin, columnist Mario Loyola. Back to you, Jimmy.
Thanks, Michelle. All right. Well, let's move to the field of politics. We've talked a lot in the shop about the Latino vote and how important it will be in November. Now, a new poll from NBC News, Telemundo, and the Wall Street Journal shows President Obama leading presumptive GOP nominee Mitt Romney by 34 points with Latinos. Now, this week, Romney spoke to a group of Latino small business owners. Michelle, we got some take.
Yeah, sure. Here's a clip. Mr. Romney speaking to the Latino Coalition on Wednesday. He's talking about improving education, particularly for minority children. Here it is.
This could be more than our hope. It can be our future. It can begin this November in the choice you make. So I'm asking for your help. I need you guys to go out and get people across the community to tell them how important this issue is.
Wow. Thanks for that, Michelle. You know, the more I hear Romney, you know, he screams at me as kind of tone deaf in all matters involving race and class. You know, he was this close to almost saying you people. You know, he said you guys. You know, and he has trouble with his potential constituents of color. At least that's the way I'm reading it. Mario Loyola, Super Mario. Now, you're a conservative Latino. Weigh in here, brother.
Well, I think that poll that showed Obama over Romney some 30 points among Latino voters, that's the basic threshold advantage that a Democrat presidential candidate has had over the Republican for a long time. The only person who was able to change that was George Bush in 2004 when he cut that advantage down to just 20 points. And a lot of people think that there was the margin of victory in 2004. And, you know, but So I think that Romney faces a challenge. It's not an insurmountable one. On the one hand, you're right. He's not, you know, the most effective communicator to some of those minority communities. On the other hand, he's a really nice guy, and Latino voters like really nice guys. You know?
Okay.
So I think he can make headway there.
Does his niceness come through?
I think it does, and I think it will more and more the more people get exposed to him. You know?
But how do you overcome, say, his pledge to veto the DREAM Act if elected, which was the legislation which would create a path to citizenship for young people who are brought to America as children if they meet certain markers, like attend college or serve in the military? And I mean, I don't know, how do you overcome that?
Well, I mean, it's not like this isn't to Latino voters what, say, a pro-choice position is to feminist voters. I mean, it's not like Latino voters are gonna vote one way or another because of someone's position on the DREAM Act.
You know what? I'm sorry. Being a nice guy is just not enough to get you elected. Word to John Kerry. I mean, it's just not gonna. He's gonna need a little bit more. I'm a nice guy. Nobody's nominating me for president.
A-Trade,
Arsalan, we all know you to be an Obama supporter. You know, has he done enough for Latinos to earn a 34-point lead, or is it just, you know, people just don't like Romney?
Well, I think that, you know, Mario hit on a fact that is a fundamental truth these days in politics, that when it comes to the minority vote in America today, the Democratic Party has had, you know, a stronghold on that. And I think that, you know, if there's a 34-point lead today, you know, the Republicans are not going to win the Latino vote or any other minority vote with a plurality of 51%. Now, if he chooses Senator Marco Rubio as his running mate, that might cut into the lead a little bit. You know, I think that at the end of the day, you know, most minorities in America realize that even though they might not be fully happy with everything that President Obama has done in his first 4 years, that ultimately, you know, the Democratic Party is the party that most represents their needs and concerns.
Corey Day.
Well, I think the Republican Party and Romney have no illusions about getting anywhere near even 40% that George W. Bush got in 2004. Their strategy is to peel off maybe about 10 to 15% or so of Latino support for Obama. Because the truth is, even though Obama has this huge advantage with Latinos, their support for him is soft. They are not as enthusiastic about Obama as they were 4 years ago. That's where the Republicans think, and the Romney campaign thinks, that they have an edge. And so if they can potentially either put Marco Rubio on the ticket or have him be a very vocal surrogate for Romney, there are polls that show that Rubio's presence, certainly on the ticket, could actually help Romney's efforts.
You know what, though? In the Boston Globe today, they asked the question whether or not Romney has written off the Latino vote. And I'm inclined to think that, I don't know, maybe he has. And that might be in his interest, because he can't seem to reach, he can't seem to get to where he doesn't sound so paternal and colonial when he's talking to people that are outside of his country club space. You know what I mean? Like I said, race. Yeah. And class seemed to stymie him.
Well, I will say, I was there covering his speech at the Latino Coalition, and he didn't sound paternalistic at all. He was pretty engaged with them, and okay. He was well-received.
It'll be interesting to see whether he makes any similar outreach to African-American voters who are just so, you know, despite the disappointments of some progressives, clearly very, very fond of the Obamas, not just him, but also her. So it'll be really interesting to see if there's any effort made in that direction as well. Okay, before we go, gotta go. We have got to talk about the NBA. Exciting week. Picks. Come on, Arsalan. Why do we even bother asking you?
Well,
green,
you know,
pants.
I think today, you know, this week, the story, the news has been, you know, the potential, you know, Shaquille O'Neal becoming the next GM of the Orlando Magic. Now, we've learned, you know, recently that that's not going to happen. And I think one of the reasons that Shaq Fu wanted to be the general manager was because Orlando was the team that drafted the Diesel, and Sheriff O'Neal wanted to be a mentor to Dwight Howard. But I think that Kazam will ultimately stay with TNT with Chuck, okay. EJ, and Kenny.
Okay, well, your picks for – I asked picks for commentator. What's your pick for the Celtics?
And you didn't even give Shaq his PhD. Now, he earned his PhD.
Okay.
He did.
Mario, who do you like?
I've got to go with my roots and pick the Miami Heat. They're starting to develop a reputation that's similar to the one that University of Miami Hurricanes had, the football team during the 80s, which is – just sort of enjoying the fact that everyone hates them.
Yeah,
that's a good point.
I don't know. I think I'm with the Heat, too. I think I am, although they do have a tendency to not be able to execute at the critical moment. I don't like the word choke. But Anyway, Corey, what do you say? But I think I'm going with the Heat, too. What do you think?
I see the Miami Heat and OKC in the finals. And as long as they're in the finals, I don't care who wins. That's going to be just balling out for seven games.
Okay. I think my husband likes OKC. Okay. So,
the Heat. It's the shoes, baby.
It's the shoes.
It's the shoes, baby.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Corey, if we'll give you the Oklahoma City if they win, we'll put that in your column too.
That's right.
We'll
KD, my homeboy.
Okay. Mario Loyola is director of the Center for 10th Amendment Studies at the Texas Public Policy Foundation and a columnist for the National Review with us from member station KUT in Austin. Corey Dade is a correspondent for NPR's Digital News. Arsalan Iftikhar is a civil rights attorney, founder of themuslimguide.com. Jimmy Israel, freelance journalist and presidential fellow at Case Western Reserve University. Jimmy, Arsalan, and Corey here in D.C. Thank you so much.
Case.
Thank you.
See you guys.
Yep.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more on Monday.